Our final case this morning is Haas v. Pacheco, number 19-8047. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. John Arcisi from the Federal Defender's Office in Denver, appearing for Petitioner Gregory Haas. Your Honors, it's a fundamental precept of federal constitutional law that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt every element of an offense, including those facts which establish the statutory punishment. Wyoming's kidnapping statute...
Counsel, I follow where you're going, and I hate to interrupt, but the question I have is, are we not under the ADEPA or ADPA standard? Is this a 2255-54, I guess it is, it's a state. Aren't we under that proceedings and the holdings of what that we have to apply to this case?
So we are in 2254, and obviously the ADPA standards do apply, and they are deferential, but that deference is not absolute. I think, to Your Honor's question, it goes to the heart of what I think is at issue still in this case, is the question of whether you have to defer to the Wyoming Supreme Court's description of safe release as a mitigating factor in its 1989 Loomer decision. And I think for at least three reasons, you should not, and indeed really cannot, simply defer to Loomer in this case.
What authority? What's the authority you're going to give me that we're not obligated to follow that?
First and foremost, Apprendi and the Supreme Court's statement that the question here is one of effect, not form. And just as the New Jersey Supreme Court in Apprendi couldn't escape federal constitutional review by labeling something a sentencing factor, nor can the state escape review here by labeling it a mitigating factor. Both Apprendi and Alleyne make pellucid that the Sixth Amendment inquiry, right, is whether or not a fact is an element of an offense, and that question is one of effect, not form. That effect is clear from A, just reading the words of the statute, right? Subsection D of 62201 literally says, and I think this is fairly fatal for the state's position, that if a defendant does not voluntarily release a victim substantially unharmed and in a safe place prior to trial, kidnapping is a felony punishable by 20 years to life, right? It sets out factual conditions that must exist for that statutory penalty to apply. But it's not just the words of the statute that we have here. It's also subsequent decisions of the Wyoming Supreme Court that affirmatively recognize that effect. So we have cases that we've cited in our briefs, like McDermott and Gould, where the state describes this provision as the enhancement portion of the statute, the fact that makes it an aggravated kidnapping. That is strong evidence that the state recognizes the actual effect, and that effect is what has constitutional significance. So to the extent that...
Can I ask you a question about McDermott? I don't know that either of you pointed this out in your brief, but the way I read it, in that case, the state district court actually instructed the jury that each of these elements, which include safe relief, must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt. And then on review, the Wyoming Supreme Court said, well, that language was inartful, but it was enough to have the jury know that McDermott had to fail essentially to meet the condition, seemingly to put the burden back on McDermott. And yet, I don't think it was inartful. I think it specifically said the state has the burden of proof and this is an element. So I wonder how we deal with that, which to me, it's just an erroneous conclusion. It's more than inartful.
Yeah.
But am I misreading what the state court instructed the jury?
There's some tension, I think, that's evident in those decisions and in McDermott itself. I think my understanding of McDermott, I think, is that it was phrased in the negative so that the defendant had to...
It was.
The defendant did not do any of the following, and that the failure... to not do any one of those would have essentially negated that aspect.
So the phrasing, what they were saying was the phrasing in the negative did put the burden on him.
I think that's where the inartfulness turns, and so that it was trying to give them the credit of trying to sort of follow Loomer in that respect, but at the same time, recognizing what the constitutional effect of that provision is.
Because the trial court did say each of these elements must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and it included safe release in that. So I just thought it's pretty confusing, but it just added to the confusion for me. But yeah,
I agree. I think the instruction doesn't move the ball forward one way or the other for us.
Right.
I think that what we rely on is really that the subsequent phrasing and recognition.
Are you suggesting that it's kind of the structure here that's the problem? If this statute would have, if Wyoming had made this statute such that it would specify what the base offense is, and then, as apparently a couple of other states have done, specify different punishments based on aggravating facts, would that be acceptable?
I think it would raise different constitutional questions than are present here. I'm not going to sort of concede the acceptability of that, but it would be different questions than what we're presented with here. I think to your question, though, I mean, the structure is important and, in fact, is what matters here, because it's radically similar, actually, to the federal drug statutes, right, which the court considers with frequency. That is, 841A, right, defines it as a crime to unlawfully possess, distribute, et cetera, a controlled substance, full stop. Subsection B then provides a series of penalties that apply depending on the presence or absence of certain facts, such as the quantity or type of controlled substance. So that if you possess 50 grams or more of methamphetamine, you're looking at 10 to life. And if you don't, you know, maybe 5 to 40. We don't expect a criminal defendant to disprove that he possessed 50 grams or more, right? The state bears that burden under Mulaney, under Apprendi. The same is true here. This is exceedingly easy, right? As a matter of both procedure and proof in almost all cases for the state to just prove the facts in subsection D. And in most cases, these are objectively ascertainable facts. This isn't even questions of mens rea at issue in some situations. It's just what happens.
In this case, it's the state. You're saying the state. What makes this a little bit of a twist is the state is. You're saying the state is obligated to prove an absence of facts, essentially the absence of any facts to indicate that he voluntarily released her.
Sure, but if the statute had been worded,
it's still facts. I mean, it's still facts that they must prove an absence of facts, but.
Most states and the federal government prove the absence of self-defense. There's nothing uniquely challenging about proving a negative. And the statute could have just been worded in the positive, right? Like if a victim is, you know, harmed, right? And done that those whims of legislative phrasing shouldn't reframe the fundamental constitutional protections, I think. So, and I do, the negative doesn't really make a difference. We're states and the federal government are used to proving the negative.
Mr. Arcisi, framed in terms of AEDPA review, why doesn't the Supreme Court's decision in Patterson show that the Wyoming courts reasonably applied Supreme Court law in this case?
For a couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, I think Patterson, particularly after Apprendi and Alene, I think Patterson doesn't really help us that much. I think Apprendi recognized that Patterson tried to reconcile Patterson essentially with Mulaney and the pre-existing cases. But it didn't find it to be controlling in any aspect. And again, reaffirmed, I think what's important about Apprendi and Alene, right, is that they reaffirmed what this inquiry is. Patterson itself, I think, sort of contains the seeds of its own limitations when it recognizes that there are constitutional limits to its own logic. And Apprendi and Alene, I think, sort of articulate what the Sixth Amendment limit is there. That is, we look at the whether a fact is an element of an offense, and we do so by looking at its effect. If the answer to that is the fact is an element, then the answer to the constitutional question is evident. We don't even get to Patterson. That being said, even if you look at Patterson on its own terms, I think the statute still fails, right? In the sense that this statute is not like the statute in Patterson, where murder was defined as here are two elements and those lead to this penalty. And then it is also an affirmative defense that you did so with an extreme emotional, extreme emotional defense and that a new penalty applies. This statute is more like the statute in Mulaney, where the main criminal statute had an element, malice aforethought, listed in the statute that said, if malice aforethought, this penalty applies. Just as here, subsection D says, if no safe release, this penalty applies. And by presuming that that penalty applies, if the actus reus and mens rea of subsection A of the statute are met, the state is committing the exact same error that was at issue in Mulaney. And Patterson, so Patterson doesn't actually answer the question, I think, on its own terms, but I also don't think Patterson really applies because we don't get to it.
So,
and again, so.
Well, would another way of understanding your argument be that based on your reading of the relevant Supreme Court case law, whether we are operating under AEDPA deference or not, doesn't really make a difference?
I think that's true. I think we have a clear established constitutional framework that really respondents haven't disputed, and that at best Patterson represents a narrow exception or departure from that, and one that just isn't implicated here. I mean, there are ways to understand Patterson and sort of try to reconcile Patterson within this framework. You know, much of Patterson was concerned about the historical roots of the extreme emotional defense within the heat of passion defense that existed at common law. So Patterson could be understood as limited in that capacity to a narrow category of affirmatively identified affirmative defenses that maybe existed.
My problem with everything you're saying is that's one way to look at Patterson, but the district court here looked at it a different way. And I find it definitely in tension with Mulaney. And I think it's interesting that the Supreme Court didn't even mention it in Lean. It's kind of like we want to just forget about it. And yet it's out there. It's out there and it's causing some issues here in terms of, you know, which case controls. And is that enough by itself to say that how is this contrary to federal law when we still have Patterson on the books? And if arguably Patterson applies, I think, you know, you've got a problem.
Yeah, certainly that's the only way, I think, really, that this case doesn't come out for Mr. Hawes, right, is that if you A, defer to the Wyoming Supreme Court's determination of this as a mitigating fact, which I don't think you should or need, which you should do, then B, the question becomes, does that mitigating fact framework, is Patterson still countenance that? Mm-hmm. And if you, my view is that A, Patterson, really, we don't get to Patterson, but even if you do, I don't think this fits within that Patterson framework for the reasons that I just articulated with respect to this is Mulaney, not Patterson, right? This is malice aforethought and safe release versus.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think it's significant too that, you know, again, that Loomer, I think, does overread Patterson in some degree in the sense that the affirmative defense framework articulated in Patterson is a very different statute, again, that effectively identifies an affirmative defense. And interestingly, Wyoming does have more Patterson-like statutes on the books and other codes. 63302 in a criminal entry statute is a Patterson statute in many ways. And I think that sort of cuts against reading it in this way. I've got a minute left. I'd like to reserve that if I could.
Thank you. Ms. Craig?
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Jenny Craig. I'm a deputy attorney general with the Wyoming Attorney General's office, and I'm here today on behalf of Warden Pacheco and the Wyoming Attorney General. And, you know, there's two things that the court has been hitting on a little bit with Mr. Arcisi's argument here today, but there are two things that are very important to keep in mind. Unlike every other case that you guys have heard this morning, This court is not sitting as an appellate court in this circumstance. This court is sitting as a habeas court, and therefore this court is limited to the review as applied in 28 U.S.C. 2254, which requires that this court simply review whether the state court's decision in Mr. Haas's case was contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And that's a very high burden. That's not a standard where this court simply looks to see if the Wyoming Supreme Court's decision was simply incorrect. Unreasonable application means that no reasonable jurist would have agreed with the Wyoming Supreme Court's decision in this case. But the second thing that that Mr. Haas cannot overcome is the fact that the federal courts are required to defer to the state's highest court on issues of state law interpretation and what that means. Now, granted, Mr. Haas relies on the statement from Apprendi, but I don't think that the statement from Apprendi is as broad as he wants to make it. The Wyoming Supreme Court's decision on how to interpret and what that kidnapping statute means was an issue for the Wyoming Supreme Court to determine. This court can then look to that determination and that interpretation to determine whether that interpretation is an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. And Mr. Haas cannot do that. And the United States Supreme Court and this court has been consistent in its deference to state courts in these types of matters. And in fact, even in McDonald versus Champion, which is a habeas case from this court stated that habeas courts do not determine whether state court interpretation of state law is correct. And so when we look to how the Wyoming Supreme Court has interpreted the kidnapping statute, the court has made clear that the elements of kidnapping are found in subsections A and B. A kidnapping is completed when a defendant unlawfully confines or removes the victim with the intent to do one of those enumerated items that are listed in the statute. At that point in time,
I guess I want to interrupt you just because I guess I understand what you're saying about what Loomer said and what the Wyoming court has said. But as counsel pointed out in his opening argument, Apprendi says we don't have to accept the state court's description of safe release as a mitigating circumstance. We have to look at what's actually happening with the statute and decide, do we have a problem under Apprendi? Do we have a problem under Alene? And why don't we have a problem? I mean, this actually, you know, the difference between this particular fact is determining both the low end and the high end of his range of punishment. Why don't we have a problem?
We don't have a problem because
putting the burden on the defendant to do that.
The reason why we don't, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
The reason why there's not a problem is because the Wyoming Supreme Court has acknowledged that the default penalty for kidnapping without having to prove any additional facts other than those found in subsections A and B constitute a sentence of 20 years to life. That is the
problem is that the statute doesn't say that, though.
Well,
putting aside what the Wyoming Supreme Court said, what does the statute say? And it doesn't indicate that there's some base penalty here. Or you see what I'm saying? It takes you right down to you know, C and D. It doesn't say that.
I agree, and Your Honor,
that's a problem.
It's not necessarily a problem. It's a different interpretation of the statute than the way the Wyoming Supreme Court has interpreted it. And while that could be a reasonable interpretation, the Wyoming Supreme Court's interpretation is also reasonable based on the language of the statute. The statute also doesn't say that the baseline is 0 to 20 unless the state proves these other facts. And to the extent that the language of the statute may be ambiguous, that ambiguity was cured in Loomer when the Wyoming Supreme Court determined that the statute should be interpreted the way that they have said that it should be. And they relied on Patterson. And, you know, to go even a little bit that one more step with what we're looking at in habeas review is Mr. Haas needs to show that the Wyoming Supreme Court's decision in this, that this statute passes constitutional muster, it doesn't violate Apprendi or Alene, is an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law or contrary to clearly established federal law. And he relies on Alene and Apprendi themselves as saying that it violates those, but those cases don't say that at all. And in fact, when we look at how other courts have applied statutes that have the same procedural mechanisms as the way Wyoming's is applied, every case that I found said that those statutes are constitutional. And that
I'm not understanding why, I guess I'm confused as to why Apprendi and Alene don't apply here, and I'd like you to address that. This finding of this particular fact, and the jury makes this finding, it determines the penalty range. It absolutely determines his minimum and his maximum. And the jury's making that finding. And the burden's being placed on him to disprove it. So I guess I'm not understanding why you just say Alene and Apprendi don't apply here.
Because Apprendi applies to a situation where the statutory maximum as designated by the legislature for that core crime is increased because of the factual existence of another crime. And Apprendi said that a jury has to make those factual determinations beyond a reasonable doubt. That is not the case that we have here. The way that the kidnapping statute operates is that once those facts, those elements in subsections A or 1 and 2 are, or A and B, are proven beyond a reasonable doubt, the sentence that the court can impose is 20 years to life. That is the sentence that the court must impose. Only after the state has proven those elements beyond a reasonable doubt does the defendant then have the opportunity to come in and prove that he voluntarily released the victim substantially.
So you're relying on your on the Wyoming Supreme Court's interpretation of the statute there. If we don't accept that that's a reasonable interpretation, then I guess that's where I'm getting confused. If we don't accept that interpretation, then your argument falls out about Alene and Apprendi now applying.
Correct? Well, and to be quite honest with you, Haas's trial didn't take place under the statute operating in any other way. And so I can't argue that his trial would have taken place consistent with an interpretation of the statute in any other way other than the way the Wyoming Supreme Court has interpreted it. But this court should not just completely throw away what the Wyoming Supreme Court has interpreted. It relied on Patterson. 1989 was long before Apprendi and Alene were published, and the court did rely on Patterson. And it fits squarely within what the United States Supreme Court said was permissible in Patterson. The state is required to prove all those.
Counsel, isn't that the point, that Loomer was decided before Apprendi and Alene, but now we have Apprendi and Alene? Why doesn't that change things?
Because, Your Honor, we still have Patterson. And as Judge Moritz pointed out, that perhaps we have some tension between these cases. And I think that we have to...
Let me come back to the point you started with, which is that we're a habeas court, doing this on a direct appeal. But let's suppose that we didn't have the AEDPA standard. Would you still be making the same argument? Would you still prevail on these arguments if we didn't have AEDPA? Or is your position driven by AEDPA deference?
I think that if we set aside AEDPA and we set aside this entire idea of federalism that we have between the federal courts and the state courts...
I just want to set aside AEDPA. Let's just do that.
No, I think that the statute would still be permissible because the Wyoming Supreme Court has interpreted that statute in a way that is constitutionally permissible under Patterson. And the fact that Apprendi and Alleyne now exist, I'm not saying that they don't have some sort of effect on the analysis here, but those cases, the holdings of those cases, which again, and I guess this goes back a little bit to what we're looking at with AEDPA, but if we look at what the actual holdings of those cases are, they just aren't applicable with the Wyoming Supreme Court's interpretation.
Well, that's fine, but you started out this argument as if AEDPA was the reason we had to accept your position, and now it sounds like AEDPA doesn't really even matter.
Well, even though I could argue that the statute is still constitutional, even if we're not looking at it through AEDPA review, the fact of the matter is that we are looking at this through an AEDPA lens, and that certainly affects how this case should be decided, because Mr. Hawes has to show that no reasonable jurist would agree with the way the Wyoming Supreme Court came out on this, and he simply can't do that. And in fact, as I mentioned—
And is that because of Patterson?
Well, many of the courts that have looked at this issue, they're looking at these kidnapping statutes, and they recognize that these statutes are constitutionally permissible under Patterson. But then they go on to say, and now we have Alleyne and we have Apprendi, but those cases just, they don't have any effect on these types of statutes because the courts aren't going above and beyond what the legislature—
What case have you cited in your brief that comes closest to the Wyoming situation and a court has upheld the constitutionality?
Well, the first one I'd like to point out is State versus Becerra. And I will point out that I could not really find any authority that had been up to the circuit courts yet. And so we're looking at state courts and at best federal district courts at this point in time. But in State versus Becerra, the Nebraska kidnapping statute is interpreted the same as the way the procedure works in Wyoming. The Nebraska Supreme Court determined that that was in line with Patterson and it didn't violate Apprendi. And the federal district court on habeas review, the court actually, I think, dealt with this issue more on the fact that Apprendi shouldn't be retroactively applied on collateral review. But it did do a discussion of the Nebraska Supreme Court's discussion of Patterson and Apprendi and how these all apply, and was very positive about the way the court applied that. I'd also like to point the court to a case called Schultz versus Terry, which came out of the federal district court in West Virginia. And West Virginia's statute is the same. There's the elements of kidnapping, which deal with the confinement, the removal, and the intent for doing so, and that the penalty for that is life. But then there are four exceptions to that. And two of those involve the defendant having to show certain facts that deal with how he treated the victim after the kidnapping occurred, which is the same as Wyoming. And the magistrate judge did a report and recommendation that did an excellent discussion of and talked about how this is a peculiar statute. It is strange, but we have to defer to the West Virginia Supreme Court's interpretation of that statute, even though it could have been interpreted a different way. And the court did an analysis of Apprendi and Alleyne and determined that those just didn't apply because the statutory maximum for the core crime, as stated by the legislature, was life. And all that the defendant was having to prove in that case was bringing that statutory minimum and maximum down. And that is not what was at issue in Alleyne and Apprendi. So those cases are supportive of the Wyoming Supreme Court's decision and how it handled this case. And Hawes's trial was handled 100% down the line in accordance with Loomer. The jury was instructed of what the elements of kidnapping were, as found in A and B. They were instructed that Hawes had the burden to show those mitigating circumstances, and the special verdict form had the jury make that factual determination.
Now, Kyle, I've got one quick question for you. If we, and I'm not saying this is where I'm coming down, but if we were to agree in connection with the arguments raised here, what is your idea of the, does he get released immediately?
If you were to determine that the statute was unconstitutional as applied, no, I would submit that it should be a conditional writ, and that the state court would, the state would have the opportunity to retry him under the
under the unconstitutional statute.
Well, I think that it's important to recognize that I don't think the statute itself is unconstitutional. I think if you interpret,
saying if we found that, if we found that, how would that work on remand?
Well, I don't know that you could find the statute unconstitutional in every interpretation. I think that it can be interpreted, if you were to determine that the way that it is currently being interpreted is unconstitutional, then you look at it the other way that everybody's been suggesting that maybe it could be interpreted, which is that those are elements. And so the state should just have to go back and on retrial be able to show, and have to show beyond a reasonable doubt those elements. Because if we look at what happened in the district court, I don't think there's an issue of proof. Because the jury already made a determination that he didn't.
He's trying to ask a question.
Sorry.
This is a question about burden of proof. And if we were to determine that the burden was improperly put upon the claimant here, you're saying you'd still get to go back and retry him? Is that your position?
Well, I think that we have sort of a unique situation here in that this question was put to the jury. So it's not like the state just failed to...
Improperly, if we go that way, if the burden of proof was changed from where the government had to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the defendant had to buy only a preponderance of the evidence. And that's the whole crux of this case, the burden of proof in regards to that. Isn't that right?
You're right. The burden of proof is the, that's where the buck stops with this case.
I raise that because it wasn't addressed in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor. And part of that reason was because that issue also was not addressed with the district court. The district court did not ever make a determination on that. The district court found. So I think that that would be a question that more would appropriately go back to the district court.
Would you have weighed that argument then? I mean, because presumably you have to assume at this stage that we might disagree with the district court and we might grant the habeas. And shouldn't you have had to argue about whether or not you can retry him? And if you didn't, haven't you waived that?
It wasn't a question that was included in the certificate.
But it's clearly, and I don't know how it cannot be a question when that's the whole point, is should he be granted habeas relief? What the relief should be would be obviously implicit and should have been perhaps addressed in your brief.
Yes, and I apologize to the extent that I didn't do that.
I'm not asking for your apology. I'm just wondering what you think about whether you may have waived that, any argument about what.
I don't believe that I've waived it because it's never been actually squarely addressed by the district court. And I think that if you were to determine that the district court should have looked at this under a different lens, it would be remanded back. And at that time, we would discuss what the remedy should be.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Craig?
No, not Ms. Craig.
All right, Mr. Arcisi, we're going to give you a little extra time because we went over on the remedy issue. So maybe for starters, you might want to address that because we were just talking about it.
Well, Your Honor, I only have really two points to make anyways. I think on the remedy, my response is that respondents didn't dispute the remedy that we advocated for in our opening brief, and that you can literally just leave it at that, that claim has, that we are asking for habeas relief. We described what habeas relief looked like, and respondents didn't dispute that if Mr. Hawes was entitled to relief because of success in the merits, that this would follow. And we can just leave it at that.
I'm not through with leaving it. I've got one more question of you, and that's in regards to Apprendi and Alene. Those are not burden shifting cases, are they? The Apprendi case is clearly, as was described by opposing counsel for you, as to what it was about. This case is about burden shifting.
So that actually goes directly to my second point, Your Honor, which is that Apprendi and Alleyne obviously deal with enhancement provisions, right? But they rely on the premise of Winship and Mullaney that that before you get to an enhancement provision, the state has already proven those facts that establish the underlying penalty beyond a reasonable doubt. And so whether it's framed in terms of burden shifting or in terms of simply establishing the facts necessary to punish someone within a range of statutory punishment, Alleyne and Apprendi necessarily depend on that foundational premise that Mullaney and Winship and Back to Time Memorial really articulate. And that's what we ultimately rely on. And in not applying Apprendi and Alleyne after, you know, not revisiting Loomer after applying Apprendi and Mullaney and Alleyne, the courts below applied the wrong law, essentially. And that is contrary to an unreasonable application of federal law. And if the court has no further questions.
No, I've got one more question in regards to that. I raised that issue because of the habeas standard that we have. And this is a burden shifting requirement, and the application of AEDPA or DEPA, however you want to. So that's, I wanted you to be sure and understand, because that's where I'm having trouble with, mainly in the standard that's to be applied and how it's to be applied and what constitutes its application in your case. So that's just my only comment, counsel.
Well, I take that, and I think that we're applying principles of federal constitutional law here, right? And clearly established rule that we've articulated in terms of the beyond the reasonable doubt standard, really fundamental foundational principles. And by shifting the burden,
okay, go ahead. You may be getting ready to answer exactly what I'm thinking.
So by shifting the burden to the defendant under this statute, the state violates those fundamental principles. And so the two are independent but intertwined in this case.
Mr. Arcisi, how do you respond to Ms. Craig's point, and she made it more than once, that as a federal court, we are bound by the highest court of a state's interpretation of its own statute? Why isn't that determinative here?
I think two reasons, Your Honor. I mean, one, just as a fundamental, like how we read statutes, there's a point at which you can't just ignore the words, right? And subsection D literally says what it says. But second, and more important, into the law.
Well, but counsel, I understand about not ignoring the words, but if the state Supreme Court interprets a state statute, can a federal court really question that?
Absolutely. And I'm sorry.
Why would that be?
Well, here it's because of Apprendi and Alleyne, right? Because they tell us, and that's my second point, is that Apprendi and Alleyne tell us how to read that statute as a matter of applying federal constitutional principles. And you do not have to defer to the Wyoming Supreme Court's reading with respect to the effect of that statute on, essentially, on the burden of proof or of on the beyond the reasonable doubt standard about what facts.
That's true if it's that's true if it's not the U.S. Supreme Court, that the lower federal courts can second guess state Supreme Court's interpretation of their own statutes.
Yes, and as sitting as a habeas court, of course, you're applying the federal constitutional law that Apprendi and Alleyne make clear following Mullaney and Apprendi, and to do so, you necessarily have to read that statute. And if the Wyoming Supreme Court's failure to revisit that statute and Loomer's interpretation after Apprendi and Alleyne leads to it that old interpretation staying, then yes, absolutely, you have to apply that current law to the reading of the statute and, again, follow what the Supreme Court in Alleyne said was the essential Sixth Amendment inquiry, which is whether it's an element. It is here, and Mr. Haas is entitled to relief. If the court has I'm happy to. I have a well over my time.
I just had one more, and this will be real quick. I wondered, I think you mentioned in your brief, or you responded in your reply brief to the counsel's citation to the Nebraska and the West Virginia statutes that she said are the same, essentially structured the same. I think you responded to that in your reply brief, and if you did, that's fine. But if you didn't, do you have a reply?
Yeah, I mean, my reply is that the analogy fails because the statutes aren't analogous. That is, that it depends on deferring to that analogy depends on deferring to Loomer. And if you read those Nebraska and Becerra and the West Virginia and Schultz statutes, they are not the statute at issue here. And that our position is that they're just simply not part of the equation. Wyoming has, by its own admission in the Doctor case that we cited in the briefs, a unique kidnapping statute. Mm-hmm. We're concerned with whether that statute, right, as applied to Mr. Hawes in this case, violated the Constitution. It did.
I was just trying to see if there was any case law, you know, that would help us. And that's why I questioned it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. RCC. Thanks to both of you. You both covered a lot of ground. Be helpful to the panel in deciding this appeal. So we appreciate that. The case will be submitted. Counsel are excused.